Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Ann Block, and I'm a regional liaison in southeastern Ohio for the Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner's office. Today, our work group session is going to deal with directives, advisories, and prescribed forms. But before we get started, I have just a couple of housekeeping things I'd like to take care of. And that is, right now there's going to be a sign-in sheet going around for this session. But we got word that there are some people that didn't get to sign the sign-in sheets from earlier sessions today. So if you missed signing in to a session that you were in today, the sign-in sheets are at the registration table. And if you'd like to sign in, that would be fine. The other thing is, since we are coming to the close of our wonderful conference, that I hope everybody had as much fun and information received as I did. I'd like to remind you that your name tags, there's a box at the registration table to drop your name tags in as you depart. So I'd come on in. Okay, so we're going to get started right now, and I'd like to introduce our esteemed panel. We have with us today David Farrell, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and Director of Elections for the Secretary of State's office. Next to him, we have Pat Wolf, our Elections Administrator. And next to Pat is Jeff Matthews, who's the Deputy Director from Stark County Board of Elections. So I'm going to start with the panel and let them have some opening remarks if they'd like to say something.
Well, I'll just briefly say a little bit of background for today's discussion. Directives, many of you know this, but directives carry basically the weight of law. They direct a Board of Elections to do a certain something or some things. An advisory, as the name implies, advises boards of something. It may be advising them that there's been a court case that requires them to do something, or it just may be advising them that minimum wage has gone up, or it may be something advising them that there's a new form, things of that nature. And then last, prescribed forms imply that it is something that was prescribed for boards to use. We have a variety of forms. In fact, do we have 460 forms, Pat?
Just 256.
256, great. We cut them in half. Yes. Anyway, some of those are petitions. Some of those are report forms. Some are prescribed by law, which is why then we post them so that boards can find them easily. So just for today's purposes, as people are talking, they may sometimes interchange advisories with directives, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of background on those three items.
I think most of you that are from the boards know that we have those posted for you. We try to keep, as we did with the presidentials, had the petition candidate petitions up on the website so you have easy access to them. Those forms are the ones that prescribe forms, some that, as David mentioned, are statutory and we must prescribe. Others we do as a service just to provide at least a template for petitioners to use, much as we do with the initiative and referendum petitions. I just wanted to do a little bit of background on those, and I'll turn it over to Jeff.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad to see so many people in this room. I realize this topic isn't as maybe controversial as some of the others at this time frame, but this is really comes down to the day-to-day operations of the board. All of these discussion items impact us day-to-day election to election, and I think that we can all have a role in improving this process.
One other thing to add as background information, the frequency of directives change depending on maybe a particular election cycle. Frequency may also change depending on litigation and the frequency of litigation, which requires certain directives to be issued. Also, last year, the legislature enacted a new provision where if a directive is to be permanent, meaning it's going to be issued and expected to be in effect in perpetuity, it must be posted for public comment. And I believe also must be proposed prior to a certain number of days before an election that it would be taking effect. Does that sound pretty right on? So that's probably a good thing because it gives boards enough leeway for a heads up. It also gives the public a chance to take a look at it. And so those are being, any permanent directive is being posted up on the website for public comment on the front end. As Pat mentioned, anything that's been issued, whether it's a directive, an advisory form, that's up on the public internet after the fact. The other thing that I would mention is, because these get issued, and because one may supersede another or provide further clarification, it quickly becomes confusing as to, well, which ones are the ones I need to know are currently in effect right now. So if I've got a May election coming up in 2009, where do I go to find the ones that are definitely still in effect? Because some expire and some get replaced. So also on our website, there is a list entitled Directives Currently in Effect. And if you go there, you would find a list of directives and advisories that are currently in effect and are sortable by number or by subject matter. So that if you're at a board or trying to administer an election and you are wondering, well, what's all the directives dealing with provisional ballots? You could sort by subject and quickly, hopefully, find that there's five or six directives relating to that subject that you're going to print off that you know are currently in effect.
Thank you, panel. Let's get right to it, and we'll start with our first question, which is going to deal with prescribed state prescribed forms. So in the 2008 election, the lack of prescribed forms may have led to some voter confusion in select counties. Should the content and design of some vital forms be prescribed by the Secretary of State for use in every county? If so, what forms may fall under this designation? Panel, would you like to comment?
Well, I think this is the easiest of the items to dispense with. I think the uniformity is very important. If you look at the 2000 election in Florida, one of the problems was policies and procedures and a different treatment of ballots. And you know, we all ought to be using the same forms. I think sometimes this happens inadvertently. And I know that printers don't bother to remind you of any change because they've got the contract, so they'll print whatever you want. Because if you recall, years ago, we all had, I guess I'm getting old now. Maybe you don't recall. I caught myself. I think it was 1991. Pat and I worked on a task force to redesign the voter registration form because everyone had their own size, color, information, and it was you know, the printing companies had no problem with that. They just, you know, you couldn't buy anything in bulk that way. They had different size binders, and we were able to do that and get that started. But this is true. I mean, it's just a simple common sense thing. We ought to be looking at prescribed forms, make sure we're not using out of date forms. I know it's happened in my county once. Okay, maybe twice, but where the wrong petition was given, you know, they change, and somehow they didn't clean out the drawer, and you know, and remember when we had that election falsification statement that changed? You know, that creates a problem. It creates potential litigation. So, to the best of our ability, we all ought to be on prescribed forms.
I think one of the primary things that we see from the elections office is the fact that we have the prescribed forms, but for convenience of staff or how you file or sort particular forms in your office, you're always wanting a different area or to slightly revise the form, whether it be for coding, stamping purposes, or sorting purposes. You want some other things added to it. Most cases, what we will look at is ask you to send it to our office for us to take a look at it to make sure you haven't changed the actual wording or text of the form, but we're allowing you a little bit of leeway as far as adding that particular box for your administrative purposes within your office.
I guess I would like to echo the same sentiments. You know, one of the challenges that we get a lot of questions on is voter registration forms. And the Secretary of State does have a prescribed voter registration form. But anybody that is new to elections, once they come in, sooner or later is going to run across a national voter registration form, which is prescribed by, who's that prescribed by, Pat?
FEC,
Federal Elections Commission. And, you know, you look at it and you're like, oh, well, that one's not right. But actually it is. It is a legal voter registration form. And then you couple that with there are a lot of groups outside of Ohio who, especially in a presidential year, decide that they want to mail voter registration forms to all kinds of different people. And they may or may not look at Ohio's prescribed form, and they may think they have a better method, or they may be trying to do one where one size fits all because they're mailing into several states. I don't pretend to have the answers, but it's on the one hand, there's people that say, well, why can't there be a law that would force anyone, you know, with a voter registration form to use the same form? And then others that say, but wait a minute, you know, certainly one size shouldn't fit all. So I just bring that up for discussion purposes. The other thing is that we also have to respect the right that there are some counties that maybe have set up a system where they have a particular form or an envelope that or a card, a postcard that goes out, and that's, you know, for us to mandate that it must be a certain size sometimes really throws a kink into their operations. So we try and work with counties on that, as well as some of them have even got sophisticated enough that they have a program set up where when those get returned, they can run it through a scanner, and the fields are automatically aligned and the scanner picks up on it. So every time we propose changing something, there are some boards that, you know, aren't happy because they've got to reprogram the fields that it's going to read. So again, I just throw that out as part of the discussion, and I'd love to hear from anybody that has any input or thoughts on that.
Like I said.
Okay, we can throw it out to the audience if anybody has any questions or comments. Okay, let's move on to number two. directives or advisories? You know, one of the central constitutional authorities of the Secretary of State is the issuance of directives that carry the weight of law. Are there specific areas that may be best addressed by directive rather than advisory, and vice versa? Are there areas that have been previously covered by directives and advisories that should now be written into Ohio law? How can directives and advisories be crafted to lessen impacts on poll workers? And finally, what are the different impacts of directives and advisories on urban or rural areas, counties? Jeff, would you like to start?
Well, I think I would like to preface this with having David or Pat describe the process by which directives are produced from the Secretary of State's office, because I'm not aware of the process, and I know many of my fellow election officials aren't either, and I think that's an important part of this discussion.
I agree. That's a good one. I'll touch base on that. First, I also want to touch on the fact that one of the challenges is courts over and over and over again seem to rule on things that appear to be disparate. In other words, if there's something where one county does it one way and another county does it another, they don't like that. And so one of the challenges is when you draft some sort of a directive. You have rural counties, which may or may not have the same resources, whether it be staff, funding, whatever, as larger counties. And so, unfortunately, the court, you know, they always use the term equal protection, I think it is. I'm not an attorney, but, you know, they want to make sure everyone's protected equally. And that provides a huge challenge because, unfortunately, we don't have the luxury of saying, well, if you're in a county with X population or less, you need to do this. And if you're in a county with X population or more, you need to do this. And we get that question a lot is, why can't that be? And again, where I work, there's at least 5 to 6 election attorneys that review these things. And I want to touch on the processes, as Jeff suggested. Some of these, I guess the first thing I should say is it depends on the directive. You know, there's some directives that are issued because there's a federal court that says, you're going to issue it, and here's what it's going to say. So right there, that's it. It's done. Out it goes. That doesn't happen a lot, but it can happen. Another reason that a directive may be issued is because the previous one expired. We touched on in another session today, every 2 years through NVRA, which is the National Voter Registration Act, there's a process called the National Change of Address process. And so every 2 years, we have to reissue that. And then there's some that come to our attention because a county board calls or emails and says, you know, we need direction on this, and or maybe a field staff member says, you know, I've had 5 counties ask me this question. They need either an advisory or directive. So once that comes in, the bottom line is usually if it's more of a policy-oriented directive, usually one of the elections administrators will take a stab at it. We'll usually try and ask for input or talk amongst ourselves about the history. If there's counties that have expressed an interest, we'll touch base with them and say, you know, here's kind of what we're kicking around. What do you think? So we'll take the first stab, and then we always, always kick it over to the election attorneys. And the election attorneys do research, and they look through revised code, and they look through former cases that are might be related. And sometimes Pat and I have ended up very disappointed because we thought we had something that made sense, and they say, no, 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 the law doesn't necessarily have to make sense. You can't do it that way. After that's done, it usually goes up to our policy section where someone in the policy section will look at it and look to see, is this conflict with any sort of policy position or policy statement? Then they'll send it back down for one final formatting in terms of how it fits on a page and whether or not the page break is in a logical place and if all the attachments are there. And from that point, it would go up to the secretary to consider as to whether or not, you know, she wants to sign it. And occasionally the secretary will have questions or say, you know, I like this, but this one paragraph I have a concern with, at which point it may come back down and we have to do some additional research and discussion. The other type of directive is something that's just more of a legal question than a policy call. At that point, one of the election attorneys is usually assigned to be the primary author. And they start doing their research and they start looking at things. Again, if there's some counties that we knew had an interest, or it could be some researchers or advocacy groups, we may touch base with them, at which point then obviously, election administrators get to look at it, where sometimes Pat or I say, well, that's fine, but, you know, what about this or that in terms of the real life application? Again, it would go up to policy, come back. Again, it would go up to the secretary. And if it's a permanent directive, as I mentioned earlier, you've got that extra step of posting it for public comment, taking that public comment, adding it to the file, before it goes up to the secretary, so the secretary can see the public comment and again weigh that against you know, what it is that the election attorneys and or administrators are proposing. This leads to some frustration because sometimes there are boards where an issue pops up, it's happening in 5, 6, 10 counties, and they need an immediate answer, but in the process of trying to thoroughly vet it and check all the legal angles and talk with some counties about it, it can end up taking a while. Now, again, in the case of a court order, that's pretty lickety-split because, again, the judge may say this has to be issued in 2 days or 48 hours, at which point, bam, that goes up. And it leads to this perception on, well, how come some things get out so quick and others don't? So I think it's good just to talk about it. And Pat, did you want to add anything on the process?
No, just sort of a follow-up. This is what actual form that gets attached to a directive or advisory when we're doing our drafting, and whether it be the interim draft or what is the formatted draft. It's just a process that we go through that David went through the steps on, and it can take a while to get through all the steps. If there's a lot of changes, if there's a lot of comments, try to get legal and administrative views to any subject, because as administrators coming from boards, we may see something that the attorneys won't coming from the legal end. So we try to get input from both administrative and legal before any of these go out.
You know, football teams have a playbook, and that's what they run everything from. We have Chapter 35, and then we have directives and advisories. We had quite a few of those this year, and you know, I would submit that right now we have the perfect time with the balance of power in the General Assembly. You know, this is the time where you get compromise. This is the time where nobody's going to be perfectly happy, but that's good, usually for law. And, you know, listening to the legislative panel yesterday at lunch, obviously they're focusing on budgets and funding, and there are some serious differences on how both parties view certain situations. But to the extent possible, we ought to codify as many directives and advisories as possible. Because it does come out down to uniformity, and it comes into uniformity of process and procedure at the boards. And it does get confusing, I know. I mean, Chapter 35, it's there. Yeah, occasionally you gotta go into the case notes and look, but you know, for the most part, it's very clear. But to the extent possible, those directives need to be added because it's very difficult to keep up. I mean, it was really good what you came up with search capability, especially since some of those have sunsetted. But what it does is it creates an opportunity for error. And let's face it, we've got, you know, 30 million election experts out there right now. So they're looking for us to mess up. And I don't know of a single election official in Ohio that, you know, that is their goal. They want to do what's right. But sometimes it's confusing. You know, there was a directive issued, and there had to be a waiver issued on that directive because it was pretty confusing. I'm not an attorney, which is good for me. But, I can read this stuff, but I've had, you know, there's been a few of them I've had to read 3 times, 4 times. And you find something buried in a footnote that you need to pay attention to, which generated the requirement of the waiver, because some people miss that footnote. And but if it's in the code, it stands up to challenge. It's not a whim of a changing administration. That's the thing that's always bothered me about the power of law with directives, is that it can change with an administration change. And any of us that have been here for a few years complained that we didn't get enough directives or enough guidance. I didn't hear that at all this year. but that, to me, that points out, yes, there are certain times when it's required to alleviate a problem. But at that volume, much of that ought to be codified.
Those are all excellent points. A couple other things that I wanted to add is, and I apologize because we were talking about the process by which directives or advisories get crafted. There are some that we know will have such an impact on boards where we actually partnered with the Ohio Association of Election Officials, invited them in, plus other election officials, and did an actual work group. A good example of this were security procedures for boards. Again, we're talking about some boards that are in very small quarters, just basically a door, a counter, and two desks, versus some boards that have up to 140 employees and an entire building that they work out of. That was a challenge. It was something important for the presidential election. We started early on that, and we were able to really take all the varying views into account, issue best practices, try and keep it flexible. I think, as Mr. Matthews pointed out, boards want to do the right thing. And they were more than happy to work on this, and also felt that they would like to submit a security plan, that they ought to each have a plan and submit that. So that's an example where I think this year, Pat and I and Jacqueline Roshu have already been talking about how can we build upon that. Now you have to keep in mind, last year there were a couple other things we'd have liked to have done that on, but in a presidential year, boards are busy. I mean, they can only afford so much, you know, time to come down. It's not they don't have the interest, but they've still got to make sure the trains are running on time. So I think that's something that we're looking at this year, is maybe to have a couple work groups, some of the same people and maybe some new ones that come on some issues that we know are going to really need a lot of buy-in at the county level. The other thing is, I just wanted to touch on the fact that I was on a board of elections for 6 years. I went through two presidential elections, and I was one of those who kept saying, you know, gosh, we need more direction, we need more direction. And there were others, and I, boy, am I sorry I was saying that. But in addition to that, one of my frustrations when I was on a board was we were expected as board members to follow all of these directives and advisories, and repeatedly had asked, can we get a copy? Can we be emailed these? I mean, if we're supposed to be responsible for that. And I was very happy when I took the position I had that we opened that up and said to any board member, anyone who worked at a board, you know, if you want to get these, give us your email and we'll copy you on that. And approximately one-third immediately leapt at the chance and said, yes, I really would like to get those. And over time, we ended up with about half of all the board members. Now, some still don't have an interest or rely on their director or deputy to interpret it and just tell them what they need to know. That's their choice. But again, that, I think, was really helpful. Now, the downside was, in 08, I'm sure there were several people that regretted giving out that email. But again, they were at least able to get that very quickly and know when it was issued, and I think that helped a lot. The other thing is, in 09, we issued our first directive, and what was the date on that, Pat? A week ago?
Yes.
So it's 09, it's a different year, and we recognized that boards were overwhelmed and stressed, and so we're trying to reduce the number. Plus, as Jeff mentioned about a playbook, again, we are going under the assumption that if you go to these in-effect directives, you've at least got your basic playbook for 09 because you know what's still in effect for this year. It doesn't mean we wouldn't reissue or revise and that we're not open to that, but I also agree with that concept of at least give us a little bit of framework here so we know what we're going to be expected to kind of do.
How about some questions or comments from the group? Please step to the mic and state your name and your affiliation with the organization you're with or the Board of Elections you're with.
Good afternoon. I'm Danita Judge from Advancement Project. And I'd like to say that I really agree with your comments, Mr. Matthews, in terms of really codifying most of those directives and making them Ohio law. One of the areas that has really kind of fallen off the radar in the last couple months is the issue of voter caging and challenges. Secretary Bruner issued a very thorough directive with regards to that issue, because basically the Ohio law said that you really do not have to give a voter notice or hearing before you remove them from the rolls. That violates not only the Ohio Constitution, but also federal constitutional law. She also basically went on to say in that directive that it also was a violation of the National Voter Registration Act, because that law does not require allow you to remove voters from the rolls 90 days before an election. And in addition, one of the other things that she put in, she took our language directly, is basically that before you can remove a voter, you know, you must have clear and convincing evidence. And so what I would say is that that is a very important directive, and it was the one directive that really was not challenged by either party, because I think that most of them realized that there was a violation in Ohio law and that there was a due process issue in terms of not giving voters notice and hearing. So I would say that you look at that again, because just because the law has sunset with regards to the 60-day notices, that could be resurrected again, and we have that issue, and we still have the challenge issue that allows you to challenge up to 20 days before a voter is before the election, and that is a violation. So I just asked to raise that issue.
Just as an aside on the 60-day notices, we just had a series of special elections in February, and we had about 70 precincts in total open, and I think there was four different school districts that were on the ballot, and we snuck those issues in there, you know, because we didn't send out the notice of election, because we're not required to, and so people got used to that. Now, I don't know what cave they were living in, but I found that humorous when you mentioned that, is that some people do rely on those notifications, and you're right, that may come back. Everybody knows when the presidential election is, but the rest of them, sometimes they just, I don't know. I don't know how they go through life, but they were upset because the school issue passed for once. So.
Well, I agree that the 60-day notices can be used certainly as an informative piece of mail, but when they are used by some groups to really to challenge voters and to remove them as they were planned to be used, and we have enough evidence to show that that was really going to happen, because those notices were being asked, you know, collected under public records law by certain groups. We know that that was a possibility, and that was a likelihood of that happening. So to use them as informative piece, by all means, but to use them to remove voters, illegally from the rolls is a different issue.
Well, and you know, we're way off subject here, but those are very expensive mailings. But if they're done often enough, then they are really, from a list cleanup standpoint, because as people move, we can find out that they've moved. Those are all topics of other discussions, sections of this conference, but there can be positives out of notifications.
Okay. Hi, I'm Melanie from Pickaway, and I'm fairly new at all this. I have a couple of concerns about directives for 2008. I heard Mr. Farrell talk about directives and permanent directives. Since I am new to this, I would like to know how I can tell the difference, because I have some poll workers that wanted to find out about some of the directives for 2008, such as 106, Directive 65, and Directive 20.
If they're not on our in effect list, then they've gone away and they would have been temporary. So anything that's up currently would be permanent.
Okay.
And anything that we're proposing to make permanent would be posted on the website from last year forward. In addition to that, we've had some discussion. If we know it's truly temporary, we probably need to do a better job of, even though it says for the May 5th election only, figuring out a way to make that clear, because with all due respect, some people still call and say, well, this says May 5th only. Does that mean it's no longer in effect? And we find ourselves saying, yes, that's exactly what it means. And just as an example, it might be ballot layout for the May 5th election, which obviously it wouldn't be the same layout for the fall. So that would be a classic example of one that it will change prior to each election, but I appreciate that because we've been talking about how do we make that clear that this will sunset after May election.
Because my poll workers were concerned about the polling location set up and are they going to have to do it again? I'm like, well, it was a directive, so yes.
Yeah, and again, I believe that's not on our currently in effect list, so it went away. So the question is there any plans to resurrect that? And we had an earlier seminar where that came up, and currently for this election year, no. And offline, I'd be happy to tell you all the reasons for the logic on that, but is that to say it never would come back? Well, next presidential, maybe it would. We'd obviously want to have discussions. It'd go through, you know, and we may issue it as a temporary, like just for the presidential in case of lines or something like that.
Okay, they'll like that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Either
of you?
I'm sorry. Okay. Did you want to comment, the panel?
Not on that.
Okay. Any other? Okay, we'll move to question three. Process for commenting on directives and advisories. How can the public have input on directives before they are issued? What changes or enhancements can be made to the comment period? David, do you want to start, please?
I'll just start by saying we're open to suggestion. Currently, anyone that would like to provide comment on a permanent directive can either fax their comments, email their comments, or phone in their comments. And again, we're happy to add other venues or think about other options. But that's currently what's offered now.
Just so the audience is aware, we actually have two directives, well, it's soon going to be one, already posted. If you go to the Secretary of State's website and go to elections and ballot issues, you will actually see, this is sort of a screenshot of it, but there's actually a button up here that talks about public comments for proposed permanent directives. And it, you can go push on that button, it'll go directly to the list of directives that are up there. It tells you, it gives you the fax number, the email, the mailing address of how to put your comments in. We've had one posted so far. Beyond these two, it was up for 5 days. We did not receive one comment during the whole period of time that it was up. Currently, we have not received, as of today, we had not received any comments on the ones that are currently posted either. But it is an area for public comment, whether it be from boards of elections, public, whoever wants to look at those directives and give input. If there's a question, if something and they're reading it and they aren't clear what it means, those are the types of comments we want to see because we want to make sure that any directive that we're issuing is as easy to follow as possible, and if there's any chance of a particular wording or paragraph being taken other than what's intended, then we need to clarify it. So do take a look at those.
I had a discussion on this subject with Pat, and you know, I know members of the association want input on directives, and this is our opportunity to have it. Maybe that should be highlighted more in some fashion, maybe another email or something. But when one of the things we talked about is that the ability to comment anonymously would be a nice addition. I think we're missing out on some folks who are, they're just not the type that want to stand up and be recognized, but they do have good ideas and they do want to comment. And for whatever reason, you know, they might want to do it anonymously. And I realize that you might get some Donald Duck things or something like that, but I think it does open up the number of responses that they could get, because we all, you know, it has been said before, we all have an interest in this, no matter what our role is in the election process, and they need that input, because otherwise, and especially from election officials, because election officials, and I'm probably one of them too, not much though, but they'll grumble at a directive. Well, here we have an opportunity to provide input, and like Pat said, you know, we didn't take advantage of it, whether that's just through not being aware of the process and the ability to do so. It could be, though, maybe somebody just does, you know, would prefer to do it anonymously.
Joe Fryer from Ottawa County, and I was just going to comment on that. Would it be possible to send us out an email saying, we've posted another directive? You don't even have to comment on the directive, just check it. Because I don't go surfing all the time.
During hours. Neither do I.
Both of those are really good suggestions. I appreciate it. And one of the other things that I wanted to touch on is, by the same token, if there is something, even after it's gone through public comment and after it's issued, if you ever have questions, please call. Now, I will tell you, sometimes it's a little frustrating because if you call an election attorney that's assigned to your region, and we have various election attorneys assigned to various regions of the state, any attorney will take your call, but if you call one of them and it tends to be more of a policy or administrative type question related to a directive. For example, you know, we want to stack our ballot boxes vertically instead of horizontally. And they're like, well, there's nothing in law to address it. They're probably going to kick you over to one of the election administrators to talk it through with you. Conversely, if one of the elections administrators get a call and it's something rooted in legal or case law or some type of judge's ruling from 1963, we're probably not going to touch that, and we're going to kick you over to an election attorney. Just because we're respectful of the boundaries, and Pat's not an attorney, I'm not an attorney, Jacqueline's not an attorney, and just speaking for myself, I'm happy with that. But also I recognize their skills as attorneys. And so I just wanted to mention that we're always happy to take calls. We do get a lot of calls, and we're always glad to talk that through. Occasionally, we will have an advocacy group or an academic or someone who works at a board who will fire off a letter because they're not happy, and invariably, one of us will call back and say, you're absolutely right. We agree with you. And they say, well, why did we have to do this and such? And we're like, you didn't have to. And it's all because what they read maybe wasn't clear, or they just assumed something. And so we're always like, you know, we'll take the letters. That's fine. And also criticism, or constructive or otherwise. But sometimes it pays off just to call and talk it through first. Then if you don't like the answer and want to fire off the letter, that's great. But sometimes we can save you the pain of having to type it up and frustration, and we're happy to do that. Anything you want to add, Pat?
No.
Okay.
Any other questions, comments on any of the questions? If you've thought of something, don't be shy. Okay, Jim.
My name is Jim Milliken with Jackson County Board of Elections, and it's about forms, and it may be off topic a little bit, but I'd like to hear a pro and con on this. Candidate petitions. Some states have where just a person will file a paper and says, I want to be a candidate. I just want to hear the pros and cons on, I mean, I'm from a rural area and there's only two of us in there. Save us a lot of time not checking signatures, and I just want to hear the pros and cons about that possibility.
Go for it.
One of the things that, as you well know, Jim, at the very small level was central committee persons. That was one of the things that was done, that a party could vote to do away with petitions, and all they did was the person just filed a form and said, I want to be a candidate for central committee. We had many parties on both sides that adopted that so they didn't have to do petition work. And what you're looking at is a wider base, I'm assuming, going from county on up to state, that they can do that. The only things that I've ever seen from the other states on that is the fact that if they didn't do petition, they usually made their filing fee higher so that they didn't have to go out and collect, et cetera. So they actually kept both versions, that you could either do a petition or you could pay the higher fee and just file the form itself. So there's variations out there. I don't know that I've ever seen a state that just went solely just to file the statement and you're a candidate. They usually had the two different versions. For the filing fee was a little bit different if you went out and got signatures versus where you're just filing the form. So, I mean, it was something that, as you know, it would take some legislative changes to have that accomplished, but it's definitely something that could be discussed.
I don't have any either, Ann. Okay. It'd be interesting, and I'm familiar with what Pat was talking about, where a central committee member can just file a form, says, I want to run. And in that case, I didn't hear a whole lot of problems with that.
No. What? And I'm not familiar with that, but does it increase participation? Or does the higher filing fee offset that? The concern I have on that is already we have villages that don't hold elections because they don't want to pay the filing fee, and so they're just appointing their council members. And, you know, and that's not even that expensive, but, you know, they just figure why.
Why go through the hassle?
Yeah. Which is not obviously the ideal situation. Especially when one family runs the village.
Yes.
I'm Shelley from Putnam County, and going back to the prescribed forms, I was just wondering if there was a way to, on these prescribed forms, if we could have a way of filling in the areas we need to fill in using the computer rather than a typewriter or handwriting it in. Just because I prefer a computer. If we screw up something, it's much easier to go back and go, oh, we misspelled. Like we had, from one county, we had a crossover school issue, and we noticed that they misspelled school. And so they redid all of it and sent it back to us and stuff, and it would just be nice because the computer would help us catch some of that and be able to check it over and fix some of it. So that's just... And some of them you can copy it out of Adobe, put it in Word, and do it. Other ones that have boxes and a lot of lines are tougher to do that with. So,
I know Pat probably have something to say. One of the things that I remember we ran into when I was at the board is our staff kind of felt the same way and said, you know, we're going to go ahead and we're going to put all these in Word format so that, you know, if somebody wants it. And sure enough, very first time out, somebody, because it was in Word and editable, rearranged the form or deleted something. We don't know if it's accidental. We don't know if it was on purpose. And then we had a big brouhaha down there. And, of course, the board implemented the policy that they wouldn't be doing that anymore. Now, maybe that wasn't fair, but that's just one thing. Now, again, with technology, I'm happy to take a look at it. There's some things that are called editable PDFs where it's locked into that format. We did have an effort where we started doing that on some of the forms, especially when it's the board itself that's required to file things with our office, because right or wrong, we feel that boards would be more likely to know it's important to preserve the format and so on and so forth. Will there be a day when there's editable PDFs for petitions? I wouldn't rule it out, but I'd also like Pat to just comment on her experience because she's been at the Secretary of State's office for how many years?
16.
Yeah, so.
Seen a few form changes during that time, like all of them. But one of the things, as David mentioned, we are trying to find some type of an editable format so it'll maintain what has to be stated according to law, but at least allow you to go in and fill in the blanks with a little bit more ease than what you have now. Our first priority is the forms that you need to fill out, your reporting forms, those type of things. Candidate forms will probably be toward the bottom of that list, but we are working on that, trying to do that. You've seen we tried to put a lot more things in Excel spreadsheets when we're sending them out. Trying to make it a little bit easier for you because I know it takes a lot of work to do all the forms. And, of course, we keep requesting more. The EAC keeps requesting more. So as we go through this, we are trying to keep that in mind as we draft these. So, yes, we're working toward that. We'll probably be trying a few more out as we go through. But we are updating, so we'll take that into mind.
And I'll be honest with you, 07, we went like gangbusters on this and really had gotten to the point where at least all the board forms were editable. And then, of course, some legislative change came along, so we had to go all the way back to square one, and we got those updated. And then, of course, ran smack dab into 2008 in the presidential, and it kind of fell off the radar a little. So this is good that you brought it up, because I can go back and tell the staff, hey, we really need to focus on this again. And I think this year would be a good year to be looking at that. Thank you.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. It's one of my least favorite websites in the whole world is the IRS website, because I don't like to deal with them. But they do have excellent forms, and they are PDF forms, and they're all fill-in. The information does not change, but it allows you to download that form, and you can, you know, whatever schedule it is or whatever form number it is, you can fill it out and then print it or email it. And I think, you know, obviously the technology exists. It's just a willpower and or a matter of budget or a matter of, you know, whatever.
Anybody else? Okay. Well, I'd like to thank our panelists. I'd like to thank David, Pat, and Jeff. They bring a wealth of knowledge to us. And before you leave, I just want to remind you.